Well, now you heard about Dallas, Fantasy Isle, American Dream, affluent style. But Robin Leach might be surprised by what I see before my eyes, watching lifestyles of the poor and nameless, sleeping on the city street. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, begging for a bite to eat. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, seldom seen on your TV. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, coming soon to you and me. Spare some change, I need a bite, just to survive an awful fight. I spend my time collecting cans while you're out working on your tans, on lifestyles of the poor and nameless, begging for a bite to eat. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, sleeping on a city street. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, seldom seen on your TV. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, coming soon to you and me. You and me. Now 30,000 children died while some politician lied. They bust the starving kid who steals while the fat cats make their sweetheart deals, on lifestyles of the poor and nameless, sleeping on a city street. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, begging for a bite to eat. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, seldom seen on your TV. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, coming soon to you and me.
Robin Screech here with another thrilling episode of Lifestyles of the Poor and Nameless. Today's journey takes us to the streets of your city, where we'll visit the homeless in their native habitats, street corners of makeshift cardboard shelters, sewer grate and doorway bedrooms, soup-lined kitchens lit by blazing oil barrel fireplaces, alleyways of the addicted, the unemployed, the destitute, the insane, eating and sleeping in the most unlikely places. It's all here on Lifestyles of the Poor and Nameless.
In the ghetto, there's always room for the ethnic population boom. The melting pot boils past the brim while the people's future's looking grim, on lifestyles of the poor and nameless, begging for a bite to eat. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, sleeping on a city street. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, seldom seen on your TV. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, coming soon to you and me. You and me. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless. The poor and nameless, coming soon.
And that's Lifestyles of the Poor and Nameless, cut by Mark Levy from his album Shiro's Heroes on Nuclear Records. Thanks, Mark, for letting us play that. Also, if you're interested in getting a copy of that, either CD or tape, you can contact him at 408-338-7283 at Nuclear Records, Post Office Box 559, Felton, California, 95018. And you are tuned to Bathrob Spears Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor in Santa Cruz, California, and around the world, particularly focusing on folks who are homeless and folks who are below the poverty line, financially speaking. I guess most of us are below the line, civil rights speaking, because Civil rights is something that the ordinary citizens don't really have in our society these days, even if you've got money to buy a fancy attorney. The question is up for grabs in the courts as the courts chip away more of our basic civil liberties. Particularly acute, however, for folks on the streets. They're in the front line of things like the drug prohibition war, the constricting situation for public spaces for those who are poor. And apropos of that, we're going to be having an interview with Kate Wells, local civil rights and cannabis club attorney, who has been closely following and, of course, is actually one of the frontline soldiers in the battle to retain cannabis as a legal medicine for those who need to use it. Of course, passed by a majority of the voters, an overwhelming majority of the voters at a county level here, and a respectable majority of the voters at the California legislative contests in 1996, but, of course, ignored by the federal government and by our state government as well. And we're going to have a brief interview with Kate discussing that. Today we're going to have an interesting show because we are trying to structure our show so that it goes out to two different audiences. Our local Santa Cruz audience, to which this show is broadcast twice a week on Sundays at 11 o'clock until 1:30 in the afternoon, and on Thursdays at 6 in the evening until 8. We're also going to try to focus on topics that will be of interest to people in San Francisco and at other free radio stations around the country. And so for those of you who aren't in Santa Cruz, welcome. Santa Cruz is a relatively small community of about 50,000 people, south, about 80, 90 miles south of San Francisco. We are a university community. We have an alternative culture here as well. But like in other communities, we are finding an increasing prevalence of not just police misconduct, but institutionalized aggression against poor and homeless people in public places, because merchants, conservative sectors in the community, large corporations in town have decided that the homeless and the poor need to be swept out of sight, under the rug, into the bushes, out of the city limits, and just down the road, preferably 100 miles west, which would be, of course, off the Pacific coast here. And we've been fighting that, many of us here. I work for a group called HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, another group called SPAN, Stop Police Abuse Now, third group called Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure, particularly concerned with the shooting of Happy John Dine, a poor person, street person, homeless activist, not homeless himself much of the time, though he has been homeless, who was shot dead by police. They found a toy gun by his side and claimed he'd been brandishing it, but all the non-police witnesses said he had nothing in his hand and was not engaging in threatening behavior. We've recently come through a whole media shitstorm, to use the word candidly, of it's more like a snowstorm, a whitewash, a complete cover-up of what really went on, and we sent it to our local Citizens Police Review Board. They sat on it for quite a while and then just rubber-stamped out the approved form. Police chief did a fine job. Gosh, why can't we keep a closer eye on mental health patients and toy guns? It's all their fault, isn't it? And we're going to be talking about that issue, too, here in the first hour. The first hour is going to be pretty much taken up with topics that I think will be relevant and understandable and of interest to folks who aren't in the area, and I'm going to try to gear the show to that. So we're going to have some callers, and there'll be room for call-ins, and the phone number here to call in is 423-5361 if you're listening to the show locally in Santa Cruz. But I'm going to keep the call short for the first hour, so if you got a lot to say, just hold back on your call till after 12 o'clock our time on this show. We're initially broadcasting on January 18th, 1998. But feel free to call in if you want to be a part of the state and national dialogue on this issue, as well as the local dialogue. First thing we're going to do is we're going to turn to the situation regarding medical marijuana and cannabis. We have a situation, as anyone who reads the papers knows, statewide, that where both state and federal authorities have moved in on cannabis clubs after a state court decision which essentially gutted the initiative passed by the people in 1996 here, saying that, well, yes, you can use medical marijuana, you just can't buy it or get someone to grow it for you. So far, most cannabis clubs, or many cannabis clubs in the state, and particularly our Santa Cruz club, has ignored that state ruling, believing that it is indeed legal for caretakers to grow cannabis. And they're, but on the heels of that decision, our state, our governor and our state attorney general have moved to declare they're going to close down the cannabis clubs. They said they're going to do it on January 12th, and it looked like not a lot happened on the 12th. As far as I know, the club is still open. But then the federal government intervened with a more serious call for a civil injunction. We're going to hear it. Whoa, off the air there for a minute. We're going to hear a conversation about that. I hope we're still broadcasting. Are we still live? I hope so. I think so. Before we do, however, we'll do a little... A little more intro music, again from the very articulate Mark Levy, who is really one of my favorites. He's been composing not just songs of national interest, but songs of local interest, which I think really is important to us here. We've had people arrested in Santa Cruz and jailed for serving free food, not recently. Food Not Bombs serves here, unlike, as you'll hear later in this hour, in Worcester, Massachusetts, where Food Not Bombs is actually under severe attack, and has four Food Not Bombsters have been called into court for sharing sandwiches without a permit, or sharing soup without a permit, which is really quite something. But let's join Attorney Kate Wells on the issue of cannabis first. Having a little trouble with the tape deck here. We're going to work on that. We had a power outage a moment ago, which is, I think, has not affected our mic, but has affected our tape deck. Maybe I can, looks like it's still on. Perhaps what I'll do is, well, let's try it one more time, see how we're doing.
While on a hunt, didn't shake me. Having someone point
a... We're actually having to cue up the tape now as we speak, but we should be shortly listening to Attorney Kate Wells, who's been for several decades a civil rights fighter here in Santa Cruz. Some of those sounds you're hearing, you're going to be understanding later in the show. They, we have a clown, Mr. Twister, who also achieved national fame for fighting to maintain the rights of people to help other people out with parking meters. I don't know if you've ever seen somebody whose parking meter went belly up, and then along came the meter maid or the meter man, and somebody stepped in and put in a quarter. Well, that's in some cities, that's considered criminal behavior, because the purpose of a lot of law is not to guarantee that people behave in a civilized and fair manner. Rather, it is to gain revenue for the government. And so the point is not to make sure that the space is paid for, but the point is to get those fines rolling. Anyway, Mr. Twister was instrumental as a clown. He went from meter to meter putting money in the meters, and he successfully antagonized the meter maids and meter folks. It wasn't a meter man, actually, and they arrested him, and he became a cause celebre nationally. So that really was the city council here in Santa Cruz was so embarrassed by that situation that it reversed itself shortly thereafter. And we're going to hear from Mr. Twister later in this show, but let's get back to the cannabis club.
At me is the only thing so far in my life that is truly shaking me.
This morning on the line we have with us civil rights attorney Kate Wells. Hi, Kate.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. So you're, of course, a stalwart attorney for the, I guess it's not called the Buyers Club anymore. What do you call it, the Resource Center?
Elvis Resource Center. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you, we've seen you recently in the TV media.
Yep.
Talking back, and also at City Council this week, bringing the issue of harassment of medical marijuana users to the public forefront. What's happening around that?
Oh, boy. Well, as a matter of fact, today is I'm driving to Oakland to a strategy meeting among all of the attorneys for the clubs. What's happening? I guess if I should go back to a basic level and explain what we have been subjected to in the club, we are, other than San Francisco, the oldest functioning club in the state. 5 years we've been in business, or, well, business is not the word for it, but 5 years we've been helping terminally ill and very sick patients without a single incident, really, of any kind of police intervention or anything. You know, all of our patients, if the club wasn't there, would probably have to be wheeling themselves down the levee trying to buy drugs from just somebody.
Violating the curfew as they go.
Violating the curfew, risking their lives in the process.
So you did have kind of a scare, I guess, a couple of years ago. I remember the club called an alert when they thought the police were going to come in and bust everybody there, local police.
Actually, not local police. We've never had a real scare from the local police. I think they pretty much always understood that we do them a service by taking the 400 to 500 patients off the street. I mean, what does this law mean if you can't have access to the medicine? You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. At any rate, federal agents, we find out now, have been visiting the club since May of last year, and have been indulging in what I consider to be a criminal conspiracy to shut us down. They were sending in agents. They have been sending in agents with phony doctor's letters, with phony diagnoses, and the doctor's letter would, of course, have a phone number. And first of all, they forged the San Francisco County Health Department forms to put this phony information on. So far as to actually dummy up the form so that it looked like an official form, and then gave us a phone number, in which, of course, even they admit that we followed up and called that phone number to verify that was a doctor and that this was his patient and what the diagnosis was. Unbeknownst to us, we were reaching the DEA office in San Francisco with the phony doctor. Saying, oh yes, I'm Dr. Eastwood or whatever.
Well, you and club, president or leader Fred Psyche spoke out about this quite eloquently before the media and the city council on Tuesday, and Fred actually broke down in tears at the prospect of, his medicine being, and the medicine of 400 patients being taken away. Doesn't this kind of make you feel pretty creepy to know that these agents are kind of running in there and...
Not only creepy, it makes me nauseated. When I think of the fact, I mean, if anybody wants to see who the patients that we serve, you know, people going blind with glaucoma, people who have MS so bad that they're confined to wheelchairs and have, you know, just incredible spasmodic episodes where, you know... people with cancer, with AIDS, wasting syndrome, and to think that these agents came through that door and sat there with their hidden audio and video equipment, filming what was going on there. I guess I feel that it's got to be such monumental bad karma on these people that they're going to meet some kind of awful fate. I mean, what are these people doing? And how can they be spending our tax dollar to do this? It is just absolutely incredible to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope people will be outraged. We're forming a legal defense fund. This is going to cost a lot of money to fight. We're a small club, but we're bound and determined that we're going to fight this with everything we've got, and whatever we have to do. I can't really divulge what our legal strategy is at this point, but
when is this matter going to reach? I guess it'll reach federal court over in San Jose, right?
Right, we are. Excuse me, we have to respond by January 29th.
And you are being sued civilly?
Well, it's kind of it's a civil action, a civil injunction. However, if the injunction issues, then, and we continue to operate, it will be a criminal contempt charge of the civil injunction. So, this is again, excuse my French here, but this is again so CS, you know, if you know what I mean.
CF?
CS, chicken shit.
Chicken shit,
this
yeah.
This is absolutely so chicken shit because they didn't want it to be in front of a jury. That's exactly why they're doing it this way. We would have preferred that they would have come in and cited us criminally so that we would have the opportunity to go in front of a jury, because I don't think there's a shot in hell that they could convict us of anything.
Are you, aren't you going to, in fact, have a shot in front of a jury if they do find that they're, get an injunction and then members violate the injunction and are taken to jail for it or are threatened with contempt of court? Or are they going to, I guess they can use the 5 days at a time procedure of finding you in contempt without a jury? Is that the idea?
Well, they could, but I just can't imagine the outrage that would ensue from them doing something like that.
I know at one time your club was talking about mobilizing behind the rights of an elderly woman who was thrown to the ground in the courthouse for having a small quantity of marijuana and trying to retain her marijuana card as she went through a metal detector. Do you think you're likely to have some solidarity on this issue?
No doubt that there'll be a lot of solidarity. I mean, we've already felt it, and it's interesting. We're the only club out of the six that were served where no individual was cited.
Mm-hmm.
Every other club had someone cited, like the director or some of the volunteers. I think that's pretty interesting. We're also the only club that has a director who is a patient.
Fred Psyche.
And I just think basically they didn't want Fred to be the specific respondent in the case.
Lightning rod, huh?
Yeah, I don't know. It just astounds me with all of the things they have to do.
In Santa Cruz, the medical marijuana movement has been somewhat split. There's been some controversy. Different organizations have formed. There's been WAM, Women and Men's Alliance for Medical Marijuana. And there's been some bad blood between some folks for a while around the issue of, should the marijuana be given away? Should it be sold? Should the issue be joined to the larger issue of decriminalizing recreational marijuana?
Uh-huh.
Are folks kind of gathering together to fight this latest attack on you as a group in spite of differences of opinion?
Well, I would hope that would happen. I haven't received a call from anybody giving their unbridled support.
Nor did the Cannabis Club folks show up last night at the B.E. Smith lecture, Jeremy Stonehill, Jeffrey Stonehill's presentation about the drug war. So, again, there may be a sort of a division in the community, or folks just not attending each other's functions or something, perhaps?
My reason for not attending the function is that I have no taillights in my car, so I can't go out after dark these days.
Call me up, sweetheart.
Yeah, I know B.E. Smith from, you know, from previous people that I've represented up in Shasta County.
Also, Dennis Perone came to town, kicked off his gubernatorial campaign here, I guess, on Wednesday.
Uh-huh.
And Perone had some very positive things to say about Scott Immler, who is, of course, one of the seminal forces behind the Cannabis Club here in Santa Cruz.
Uh-huh.
Scott has had some rather nasty things to say about Dennis Perone, although I don't know how recently. Is there some sort of a kind of a peace in the offing? Are people supporting each other now that there's this sort of general attack, sort of like people kind of turning aside from what some of us seem to be petty squabbles or even maybe even significant differences of opinion, but in the face of a greater enemy?
Well, you know, it's a difficult issue. Let me define the issue first, and then it'll be easier to understand why there is this difference. We have tried very hard in Santa Cruz and Scott with his L.A. club to follow the guidelines of the law by verifying each patient's medical credentials, by not allowing children in the club, by being, you know, careful to keep it as a pharmacy would be, for instance, for any other kind of medication. So we've been very careful about that. Dennis, on the other hand, was very lax and didn't basically anyone could scribble a note on the way in the door or just say, oh gosh, I hurt, and they would get their medicine.
But it didn't seem to make much difference when the chips were down. They went after both of you, right?
Well, but we have a much better defense by the fact that we've been that careful. I mean, they had to admit in their own declarations that we did call to verify the doctors, which is as much as any pharmacist would do.
Interestingly enough, have you read today's Santa Cruz Sentinel?
I am in the process of right now.
I don't know if you noticed, but on page 2, No Blues, Just News by Don Miller, there's the following brief statement. Or take Dennis Perone.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrobs Pierre's Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor. We are listening to Kate Wells, local attorney for the Cannabis Club, and we are turning over the tape. You want to call in to our show?
Dennis Perone. Perone is the San Francisco-based guru of the medical marijuana movement, and he showed up in Santa Cruz last week to launch a bid for the Republican nomination for governor. He also stepped right into the middle of the latest furor over pot clubs that have sprung up in Santa Cruz, among other places. The federal government is trying to shut down some of these clubs, including the local one, after drug agents are able to get pot with forged doctor's notes. Oops. Isn't that the fatal flaw with these, quote, clubs, unquote, anyway? Certainly people with painful or terminal conditions should have the right to pain-killing medications, and maybe marijuana is truly an extremely effective drug to do this, but who decides who gets it? The feds say the fact that marijuana is illegal supersedes the voter-approved state measure. Sounds like Don Miller is not on your team, or is that a misreading? What do you think?
I think he is on our team, because that's what we have been doing, is being very careful to document this. I mean, what's the alternative to this? What are these terminally ill patients supposed to do? They're not able to grow this medicine themselves. So what are their options?
They can hurry up and die, perhaps.
You know, I mean, to scrounge in the street to find somebody will sell them drugs, who might also hit them over the head and rob them, or, you know, try to sell them other drugs that are, you know, not necessarily, there are no options. I mean, where can these people find a safe place? We have elderly people. We have some, you know, we have a priest. We have, you know, where are these people going to go?
You also sought from the Santa Cruz City Council some kind of government response. I guess you may be getting, you also are maybe seeking something from the Board of Supervisors as well. Is that?
That's correct. Evidently, there has already been a proclamation issued by the Board of Supervisors. And yes, we will be seeking some support from the city, and it appears to be forthcoming. And everyone seems to be outraged at the callous kind of attitude.
You certainly prompted a rare response in me at City Council. I actually found myself applauding Mike Rodkin and holding my nose as I did so, I must say. Rodkin found himself commenting on my applause, so you got us away from our usual polarization on the issues.
Recall what I said when I first walked up to the podium. I've been here on many, many divisive issues. I hope I'm here on a unifying issue at this point. So
what's the next court date down the road, and how can people help?
Our hearing is March 2nd on the motion for preliminary injunction. Like I said, our response is due January 29th. We've established a legal defense fund, and as far as finding out how to help, you probably should call Fred Psyche at 429-8819 or myself at 457-1545.
429-8819, or they can call you up at
457-1545.
Okay, and if you've missed any of those numbers, call after the show to 423-4833, 423-HUFF, easier number to remember perhaps, and I will give you those numbers again. Kate Wells, anything you want to add on this situation or any other civil rights issues before we go?
This is another one of those, you know, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention issues, you know, it's the will of the people has been shown, and it's just incredibly outrageous that all of this is happening over this. It
takes your words away.
I am almost speechless, and that's a very unusual situation for me.
Indeed.
All right, thanks.
And again, for those who want to support the Cannabis Club, give a call to Kate Wells at 457. Boy, I've spaced it out. 457. Huh. You know, I know that number. Give me a call at 423-4833, and I will get you the number. That's 423-4833. That's not the on-studio number. It's the number for HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the organization I work with, and you can call that at any time. Leave me a message, and I'll get back to you. 457-1545 is Kate Wells' phone number, and I'm sure she'd be glad to hear from you. She needs all the help that she can get on this issue. So again, you're continuing to be tuned to 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Free Radio needs your help as well. We are almost out of a studio. We are essentially being evicted, not because of any disagreement with what we do, but rather because of the usual market considerations of the property that we happen to be on. And we need a new place to go to. We're still looking desperately for a place. If you can help us in any way, if you like the shows you hear on this 96.3, if you think that they're worth supporting, we need a place to broadcast from. Give a call. Leave a message on our voicemail at 427-4523, 427-4523, or give us drop us a $5,000 check, maybe a $100,000 check. We can buy our own property, P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Free Radio Santa Cruz. Online, you can reach us at frsc@cruzio.com. frsc@cruzio.com. My show is about civil rights for the poor. And, of course, the most extreme example of deprivation of civil rights is when they take your life. And that's what happened to a poor man, a man without money, a developmentally disabled man, a homeless activist and a person who spoke out against police brutality and marched and demonstrated against it, a man named Happy John Dine. Happy John to his friends. He was shot dead on November 12th last year by Santa Cruz police officer Connor Carey. There's no dispute about that. The dispute is why and how did it happen. The police department decided that Dine was brandishing a toy gun. Actually, first they said he was pointing it in a combat stance in a menacing manner at Officer Carey and his partner, Martin Over. Then when Well, we count about 15 or 16 eyewitnesses. All the non-police eyewitnesses said he had nothing in his hand. Happy John had nothing in his hand. Happy John had nothing pointed at the police. The story changed, and it became he was reaching for something in his clothing. A toy gun, it turned out to be later. Well, our Citizens Police Review Board initially declined to get into this issue with an emergency meeting or a special meeting or an early investigation, all of which it had the option to do. And it instead went through its usual closed meeting process, holding three closed meetings on, I guess it was six or seven or eight complaints on the issue of both excessive force by Officer Connor Carey and also a cover-up by the police department and police chief Steve Belcher, because the police department had decided 3 hours after the shooting what happened, put out a press release essentially saying that Dine had pointed a gun at the police officers when it became clear that no such thing happened. This was a story the police department stuck to. It's still a part of its final press release and also of the district attorney's press release. It seems that to many of us who formed a group called Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure that something was not right here. Some of us said it was a murder. Some of us said we didn't know what it was, but it sure looked like a cover-up. All of us wanted more information. And unfortunately, none of us got it. And that's what you're going to hear now in a tape of the Citizens Police Review Board's public statement on the issue. They issued three pages, some of which I read at my last show. And you'll hear the first three paragraphs of the statement read by Citizens Police Review Board Chairperson Bill Christie, who is the conservative appointee to the board. Actually, they're all pretty conservative. But nominally, our city council is split 6-1, quote, progressives versus one conservative. In fact, there are really two progressives on the city council, and they're kind of timid at that. That's Celia Scott, our mayor, and Catherine Byers, both of whom try to do things like allow the voters to make choices about the homeless garden project, whereas the developers seem to have the rest of the council in their pocket, rolling right down the road with their vision of a greater Santa Cruz. Greater for whom, greater for what, of course, is the question. And the people that elected that city council, the progressive community, is really kind of aghast at the monster they've created. And we'll see if what they do at the next election, which comes up in 1998. That's local, though, and let me continue to focus on this issue as something that people in other communities can understand without really following a lot of the ins and outs of our Santa Cruz politics. This is the first police shooting since 1991, and police killing, I should say, by gunfire. And the case was, as I said, remarkable in that every single eyewitness, except the two police officers who were involved and their ride-along or bring-along witness, Ben Newman, who's a bouncer for a bar called The Catalyst, who originally filed a complaint against Happy John Dine for brandishing a gun. Every non-police witness said that Dine had nothing in his hand and that he wasn't acting in a threatening behavior and he was doing nothing, that he had his hands at his side. At least some of them said he had his hands at his side. Some of them didn't comment on this subject. But it was clear that the original story put out by the police department and the district attorney's office, never repudiated about his pointing a gun at the police officer, was unsubstantiated by all non-police witnesses. Well, here's what the Citizens Police Review Board could have done: a number of things. It could have, even without holding an early investigation or special hearings, which they both had the option to do, as I said before, they could have called for public hearings, subpoenaed the officers, subpoenaed the witnesses, had them recount their stories and be cross-examined on their stories to see what, in fact, the truth was. Because, in fact, the witnesses were only examined by police officers, and then the two police officers and Ben Newman were also examined by the district attorney. And, in fact, the district attorney may have done a little more examining. The district attorney's office may have done more examining of other witnesses, but we were able to only read in a report that was made public, thanks to Mayor Celia Scott, and is in the public library for those of you who are interested. Only those three individuals, the three police witnesses, we can read the accounts of the district attorney interviewing them. The rest of the interviews are by the police department. As at least that's my reading of the report. So, the question here is, why did they weigh the testimony of the police officers so heavily? Well, they were the closest witnesses, it's true, but they were also, of course, the most involved. I'm getting a phone call. I'm going to take this call briefly, and then we're going to launch into the tape of the Citizens Police Review press conference. We're going to have to make this brief, though, caller.
Hi, caller. You're on the air with Free Radio Santa Cruz for a brief call.
Connor Terry had a lawyer present when he was interrogated. His name is Robert J. Katz.
Uh-huh.
And 314 Capitola Avenue, Capitola, from the legal firm of Katz and Lapides.
I guess that's probably standard
process. Extremely, well, it may well be, but let's remember the guy was interviewed that night in Bang Zoom. He's got a lawyer with him. And
well,
the lawyer, of course, is going to dodge whatever he's going to tell Mr. Connor what to respond to and what not to respond to. Just an important little caveat, I thought.
Thank you.
And last thing, let's remember the dead guy can't testify.
That's true.
Take care.
Thank you, caller.
It actually is standard practice if a police officer is being questioned. Probably the Police Officers Association provided the attorney because, in fact, the police officer was a murder suspect, or certainly a suspect in some kind of a homicide here. Not just a suspect, he killed the guy, and the question was it justified? So it's still interesting, you know, to get all the details of the case. Let's turn now to that report by the Citizens Police Review Board, made public last Tuesday at noon in front of City Hall.
The Santa Cruz Citizens Police Review Board finds the shooting of Mr. John Dine by an officer of the Santa Cruz Police Department justified in accordance with police policies and procedures of the Santa Cruz Police Department. The opinion of the board was reached following extensive review and consideration of the district attorney's formal report, supplemental material provided by citizens and witnesses, commentary provided by citizens at several meetings of the CPRB, and audio and videotaped interviews with witnesses and officers involved, and the dispatch tape. The board then engaged in several hours of deliberation during three closed sessions. In these deliberations, the board focused on three issues. First, did the officers act in accordance with department policies and procedures? Second, would the public be served by an independent investigation? And third, is there anything to be learned from this tragic incident? I'm open to questions.
What about the right to confront witnesses? How was that handled within your process?
Can you explain yourself?
Well, in a trial situation, witnesses are confronted. It's an adversary system.
Mm-hmm.
The truth comes out by the confrontation between two parties. How is your process different than a rubber stamp process? How is it something that would have the respect of the citizens of this area?
Most of our witnesses were audio and videotaped, and we read their statements. And
should we adopt that in our trial situations in this country?
This isn't the court. This isn't a trial situation. This is a review board, and we're reviewing an investigation.
Yes, sir, but how can you do that without using the standards that are used in trials or even evidentiary hearings or other process of court? How can you do that by a videotape? A videotape is a one-sided affair.
Yeah, we are not a court system.
You're not much more than a rubber stamp, in my opinion, sir.
You're entitled to your opinion.
If this case doesn't bring a police review into it, I don't know what does. When Marina had an unjustified killing of a 5150 such as this, even the police chief there said, perhaps we could use police review. I don't think this police review is what he was referring to.
Okay. Anybody else?
Sure, I just want to know some of the recommendations that you've made to the city council. How can you go about making those changes, if you will? Can you just tell me what those are?
Okay. They're also in the report here.
Right.
The reports to city council are, one, to conduct an assessment of the training of officers in the identification and handling of mentally and emotionally disabled individuals. Second, to conduct an assessment of the practices and procedures for integrating officers into the downtown area or into any area that attracts a high population of the mentally and emotionally disabled. A third recommendation was to request an audit of John Dine's case management from mental health officials who were responsible for his care and case management. And the fourth was a recommendation to the city council to be looking at drafting an ordinance limiting the sale and ownership of realistic looking toy guns.
How realistic is it to
I mean, how realistic is, does the gun have to be, or how realistic is
well,
the department that
to get these to work?
Okay. I think the city council is already interested in that. I know that the chief of police has been looking into, toy guns for some time. He gave me some literature after the shooting about toy guns. And apparently this is a problem that's taking away throughout the nation.
What about the mental state of people on the street dealing with them, the police officers?
It's always a challenge. Yeah, we don't really, as a board, know how extensively they are trained in dealing with mentally disadvantaged people. And this was just to get discussion going to make sure that we're really up to speed on handling mentally stable people.
Now, you guys met three times. I mean, what was the... why so many times? I know it wasn't open and shut, but...
Yeah, there were quite a few... odd objects. We had to study a lot of the reports. We got additional information as we held public meetings. We reviewed the additional information. We brought additional things in, like the dispatch tape wasn't part of our original investigation. We heard from the public. We had to discuss things. We had to kind of dissect it. We did spend a lot of hours just discussing the various facts from different people's perspective, and ultimately we were unanimous in our decision.
What kind of message does this serve to the community and to the police department, or is there a message?
Well, I think that maybe one of the recommendations are obvious. We need to look into mental health problems. We need to, we all feel it's a very tragic thing, everybody does. We are sorry that this had to, that this did happen. We feel that limiting look-alike guns would be a step in the right direction, looking into the mental health system. And I don't mean to be critical of our mental health system. We just want to make sure people aren't falling through the cracks. John Dine had some problems, and it ultimately cost him his life.
Was any investigation done into contacts between John Dine and officers over in Cary in prior incidents that might have been involved? Did they have a prior relationship? Did they know each other? Did you investigate this in any way?
Well, we accepted the statement of Officer Cary that he knew witness that rode along with him. They'd gone to school together, apparently. As far as any previous contacts, I'm sure they had numerous contacts. Ben was a bouncer down the Catalyst, and I'm sure he had contact with the police department there. Probably quite a few officers.
No, I mean John Dine and the two officers.
Oh, I'm sorry. John Dine. I know that Officer Over was familiar with John Dine. Officer Cary apparently wasn't. Ben, I'm not sure. I'm sure he's had some contact. There were a number of statements, as you know, that they knew each other and that they didn't have a good relationship. But it seemed from the context of the investigation that initially, at least, Ben was not aware of the fact that the man with the weapon was John Dine.
Do you have any indication of any arrest record of John Dine in Santa Cruz for violent behavior, specifically for any, has he ever been charged with assault in Santa Cruz or elsewhere that you have specific knowledge of?
Yes, I do have knowledge of him being charged with assault.
And where was that?
I'd have to get the police record to, I could share that with you, but it's...
Was he convicted?
I don't know. I know that he was charged on a number of occasions. And as you know from the investigation, there were numerous reports of his violent behavior when he wasn't taking his medication.
Now, there were three witnesses who, in essence, whose report this seems to be an affirmation of, Ben Newman, Officer Cary, and Officer Over. There were nine other eyewitnesses who said they saw no weapon in Dine's hand, who said they saw no threatening behavior, who said they didn't see him move toward the officers, and who said there was no combat stance, as Police Chief Belcher and District Attorney Art Danner initially claimed 16 hours after the shooting. What did you do to reconcile the fact that nine witnesses saw something that directly controverted what the three police witnesses said, one of whom was a friend, Ben Newman, of Officer Cary's?
Mm-hmm. We felt that the majority of the inconsistencies were attributable to the distance from the incident, the darkness, and the vantage point of the and the expected variances of human observation. We felt that the people that were in the closest proximity to the shooting were more
reliable because of their position, and their witness statements more closely corroborated the police department statement.
Were witnesses Mike Schultz and Stacy Buckaloo, who were in the car right behind the shooting, interviewed at the same length as officers Carey and Over? And what did you make of their testimony, their direct testimony to your board, I guess, on December 9th, that the shooting was, quote, murder?
Their vehicle was the fourth vehicle back, and I think Stacy even said that she couldn't see because of the truck in front of her. So I feel their vantage point wasn't most advantageous.
Read the reports again.
Ms. Buckley said that she saw nothing in his hand, and she saw his hands. There's one point in which she did not see one of his hands. What about the witness Tom Murphy, who claimed he saw from the other side, from the long side, the man Dine standing there with his hands at his side and then shot by the police officers? Do you completely, essentially, feel that this testimony is an error?
We went with the preponderance of the statements, the people that were closest to the scene, and we put more credence in what they had to say.
And this happened, of course, to be the police officers.
Well, it was the police officers and the person in the back seat of the car and a woman driving by who is a social scientist who's trained in observation.
Are we talking about Liana Forrest?
Yes.
And are you saying that Liana Forrest saw a weapon in John Dine's hand?
No, but she saw him in a stance that it could have been a weapon. It was a small black item at night. I think it would have been hard to see. There was a weapon found at the scene.
Isn't it true that the police had their spotlight on John Dine? So you attribute the darkness and of people's... No, it's actually, I do know that. I was there.
He doesn't know. He doesn't even know if they had a searchlight on him.
Well, they did. They had a searchlight on him. So how can you attribute the darkness?
One of the officers stated that the light was on, and the other officer stated that the spotlight wasn't on him. The headlights of the car were pointed toward the person, yes.
And isn't it true that the coroner's forensic evidence disputes the fact that he was in a combat stance?
I think the combat stance theory has been pretty well dismissed.
Even though it was repeatedly given out by the police chief and the district attorney first 16 hours after the shooting and then when the case was concluded a week later.
Yeah, I still say I think the combat stance was dismissed. I don't think that there's any evidence of that.
Did you find Newman's testimony credible, even though Connor Carey stated that from his position in the back of the car that he probably couldn't see the events because of the grid that was blocking his view?
There were some inconsistencies in Newman's statements that we attribute to just the fact that the events occurred very rapidly, and it was his observation as he saw it that he relayed to the interviewers.
Did you discount his statement that Connor Carey had told John Dine to freeze five times before the shooting occurred?
I feel that when things happen very rapidly, people have difficulty getting the facts exact, and I think it's unlikely that he said to freeze five times. Even Connor Carey wasn't sure how many times he said it.
And weren't you concerned about statements from four eyewitnesses who claimed that the officer said, don't move, after he'd been shot and was lying on the ground?
Yes, there are people also that said they heard that before the shooting, so I'd have to get the investigation out.
Is it possible you can answer these questions later?
Sure. You can submit questions to us and we'd be happy to answer them.
Wasn't it Ben Newman that said that he had said don't move before the shots and no other witness?
I'd have to check on that.
You feel that Ben Newman is... I'm sorry, you wanted to say something.
Yeah,
go ahead. Yes.
One was about the training of police in terms of disarming a person rather than... I mean, where they shoot. It's shoot to kill versus disarming them. Was there any conversation about that?
The police department has what they call general orders, and the general orders are written to where they don't try and incapacitate someone or try and minimally disarm them when they feel their life is in danger. The officer felt that he was in grave danger, and that's why he fired when he did.
The second question is about public process. I mean, your decision is one thing. The way that you came about it is another thing. And I think that a lot of the community wanted an open process to find out, a public hearing, in order for them to be included and to hear exactly the thought processes of what you were going through, all the information, and a chance to, you know, voice their concerns. Why did you opt not to have a public hearing or a public process in this?
Jane, we felt that the evidence was substantial in corroboration with the officers. We felt that it was clear what had happened, and that a hearing wouldn't have augmented the decision that we were coming to.
You could have made a decision before that to have a public hearing. It didn't hinge on the fact of you believing it or not. It could have you could have just decided that the community needed to have this in a public way, you know, open procedure, because of, you know, finding out what's going on, healing the community, whatever. And so you could have made that decision previous to that. Why did you not?
We just didn't feel it was indicated.
You didn't do an independent call for an early independent investigation in November. You didn't call for a special meeting in November. In December, you didn't meet until late December, leading a lot of us to be concerned that you weren't taking the issue terribly seriously in terms of the fact this is the first shooting here in Santa Cruz by a police officer since 1991 that I'm aware of. You also have declined to hold public hearings, and you don't even mention public hearings in this report. You mention you decline an independent investigation, which would require the city council to disperse some money, and for you to spend some money, but public hearings would be much less costly. They would simply subpoena officers and witnesses and require them to publicly state what they have said to you. And since a lot of your testimony and your conclusion hinges on three witnesses, two police officers and the friend of Officer Connor Carey, Ben Newman, who some claim was in altercations earlier that day with Happy John Dine, so he may have had some sort of personal thing with Happy John Dine, don't you feel that it would increase the credibility of your ultimate decision to have these matters gone through in a public process, a deliberate fashion where folks could air their concerns?
Well, I did feel that the public aired their concern at our public meetings. We felt that we'd heard, in fact, we heard from a couple of dozen members at least of the public, and we did hear their concerns, and we considered those. We just felt that the facts were clear enough that we could go ahead and make a decision based upon the information that we had.
But the facts, of course, are the testimony of three witnesses, correct? And plus you add Liana Forrest, but she doesn't confirm there was a weapon in Dine's hand. The only people who tell you that are the police officers and the friend of the police officer in the back of the car, Ben Newman. So doesn't it seem wise to examine the witnesses, particularly since the people who are initially examining the witnesses are police departments themselves, admittedly, if not the SCPD, then the Sheriff's Department, which has, to some extent, an interest in seeing that this case, I don't wish to say that they are in any way corrupt or acted inappropriately, but this is an in-house investigation, in a sense. We're in a small community here. Don't we need the reassurance of some kind of independent oversight here? Because isn't that, in fact, why you were formed, for independent oversight?
Yeah, again, you're right. We are there for oversight. We review investigations. We are not investigators. The problem with investigating a shooting is that people that are investigators are usually affiliated with law enforcement. There's a protocol in place that's been in place for a long time where any shooting, discharge of a firearm, is investigated by the DA's office. And while, yes, the DA and the police department have similar goals, they are independent. I've been assured that the officer that primarily in charge of the DA's investigation is not a rubber stamp, that he feels he's very good at digging into issues and dealing with departments as necessary.
Who assured you of this?
Other people that are in the department and other people I've talked to.
Sir, I can't questions. What is the cost of ordering up the independent, what these guys are asking for?
The independent investigation? I have no idea. None at all. We weren't concerned about the cost of it. We figured the city could afford it if we felt that it was an important part of the investigation.
Were you concerned in any way about testimony that the three witnesses had, that they saw Officer Over remove an item from Happy John Dine's clothing and toss it to the ground after the shooting? There are some of us who wonder whether that wasn't an after-the-fact presenting of a plastic gun And were you concerned about the interaction between officers Over and Carey, where supposedly a dispute erupted between the two of them, an angry dispute witnessed by several of the eyewitnesses? Did you inquire into that?
No, I didn't consider that to be an angry dispute. There was a mention of a distance between them physically as they were dealing with other things earlier in the day. As far as where the weapon was found, it is hard to say. The officers, there are several different accounts of where it could have been. Officer Carey said that it was down between the person's legs where he fell. Other people felt that it looked like he was removing it from his clothing. It's hard to say, Robert. I don't know.
What about Clinton Hennis and Lee Chiron, who testified to the district attorney's office that they saw Officer Over remove something from Carey's clothing and throw it to the ground?
Mm-hmm.
Did you credit that as a reliable testimony?
Are these not the same two people that said that the other officer shot him from inside
the
patrol car?
No, there was one individual, I believe it was Mike Schultz, of the pair, Mike and Stacy Buckaloo, who wasn't sure which officer actually named the other officer as the possible shooter. Now, these were other individuals. Lee Chiron, actually, I didn't know about until after I read the district attorney's report, and the other... Clinton Hannes came after the shooting and did not see the shooting, but did see Officer Over act after the shooting had happened.
There were, of the many witnesses, there were probably 12 people, maybe more, who came forward and gave statements, and every one of them was different. There were none that completely corroborated, that were completely concentric. So I feel that we had to just go with the gist of things and look at the proximity and make a decision based upon the information we had.
So you don't think that the fact that none of the eyewitnesses other than the police and the police-related eyewitnesses saw a weapon is a point of consistency among all those witnesses?
I feel that it was dark and that it's possible there was a weapon without it being seen.
I didn't know whether it was dark or not. I thought you said you didn't even know whether there was a spotlight on it. What do you know? You don't even know whether it was dark or light.
Officer, didn't Officer Parker report that the headlights were on the police vehicle when he arrived at the scene, indicating that the scene was lit up by the headlights of the police car the entire time?
I'm not sure that Mr. Dine was consistently within the path of the headlights. There was some controversy whether the spotlight was turned on or not. I can't say for sure about that.
Maybe that's something better to roll.
Was there any discussion of public hearings independent of an independent investigation, since that would be a somewhat simpler process in terms of financial costs and so forth?
We discussed both an independent investigation and a public hearing, and we decided that we really didn't need any additional information to come to a decision.
So you felt that, you weighed the testimony of the police witnesses as being more credible because of the fact that they were closer than that of the other witnesses, even though they outnumbered the police officers, and they, of course, in a certain sense, must be viewed as more independent because they weren't involved in the incident.
We felt that other people that were in proximity were close enough to the police's statement that we believe that the statement...
Other people being...
Other witnesses.
You're talking about Ben Newman?
No, I'm talking about...
Sir, we have a few questions here. Obviously, can you comment a little bit just on the significance of this case to the review board? I mean, is it fair to say this is probably the biggest case since the board's creation?
Unquestionably. Yeah, and we spent more time on it than any other case, and we've what-ifed about every possible scenario, and we've discussed a number of possibilities. We've looked at each different individual statement and decided how credible they seemed to be.
Uh-huh.
And,
weren't you concerned that three eyewitnesses called it murder?
We want to thank Mr. Christie on behalf of the City Council for having this conference today. We want to thank the Police Review Board for...
you
want to
answer the question?
You're not closing it down. Hey, this is his conference. You're not on the board. You're not on the board anymore, Michael. Why don't you back off and let him make his own choice?
He should answer my question.
And he's also in the middle of an interview with John, so why don't you just let him proceed? Who do you think you are, Michael?
Yeah.
Really?
God, Michael.
Who do you think you are, Robert?
I'm not trying to stop the conference. You are.
Man.
Yeah, that was a little too embarrassing a question, huh?
Caused the board the most concern. I mean, was there one thing in the process that you really looked at most seriously, like a red flag in any part of the investigation?
I would say that, actually, to answer their question, was were we not concerned about this being called murder? We were concerned about the public's feelings on this. We considered everything said to us. The claim of murder was something that we all heard and we were concerned with, but we just thoroughly investigated it, and Karen, we did our conscious best.
There was no
to discount all three of those eyewitnesses' statements.
Did these officers have personnel files that were reviewed for complaints prior to these incidents?
Yeah, I got to butt in here because I really got to go. Yes. Given, obviously, there's still an amount of dissatisfaction with this, do you think that the review board is effective? I mean, it was set up to sort of diffuse this exact kind of debate in the community, and yet it seems obvious it's never going to go away. Do you feel like the review board is an effective organization?
I do, and I think our mere presence makes law enforcement better. I think it makes them more accountable.
Were the personnel files reviewed, Bill, for the officers involving past complaints?
No.
And can I ask you about this last sentence here? That you would be abdicating your responsibility and needlessly, if not recklessly, delaying the board's decision by calling for an independent investigation? That it would be reckless, that there would be a delay in time to call for the independent investigation, when in fact you didn't do anything for several weeks?
We did more than you realize. We had a lot of information to digest. We couldn't get together initially because a board member was going to be away. We felt the full board was essential to discuss a case of this magnitude.
But why would it be reckless to call for an independent investigation?
That I didn't choose that word, by the way.
So you don't agree with that?
I left it in on a person's sentence. But I feel that there is a lot of public clamor for moving the investigation along and moving ahead with it, and that an independent investigation would only delay it, that the person would be looking at the same facts we did and be very likely to come to the exact same conclusion that we did.
But you'd be authorized to go to the city council and say, we'd like to have an independent investigator, a licensed investigator, do some research on this. You'd be authorized to ask them for the funds to do that. Isn't that correct?
If a private independent party chose to investigate this case, would you be open to a dialogue with them?
Yeah, I think we could dialogue with a private party, yes.
You've used the word investigate, but actually in your own activity, but investigate, you mean read over the police reports?
Review is a
review.
Term, yeah.
So in essence, you have done no real investigation.
No, we're not
of this
investigators.
Issue.
You're right, Robert. We are only reviewers of investigations. Yeah.
That's a good distinction. I'm glad to hear you make it.
Yeah, see, we're a review board. We're not an investigative body. We the DA's office did the investigation. The police department did additional investigation. Okay.
As a citizen, I feel like what you've done now is exonerate the chief of police, who ultimately is the person that's most responsible for this, since he is the man whose training and mindset these officers carry out. He's not even an elected official, and the person that hired him is not an elected official, the city manager. And yet you seem to defend the city council had no... what are you going to call it? No way to deal with this. No, that you exonerate them of any responsibility, too. So we as citizens, who are we to look for when it comes to us having complaints about excessive force, excessive methods of enforcement amongst our police officers? And if this isn't a political fallout, this man's death isn't a political fallout, and that for that type of politics, what am I to do as a citizen? If you can't have some effective results from, I supported the beginning of this police review board thing. I haven't followed through on it because I saw people I felt were responsible leaving it. So I come here to see what was going on, and I feel really frustrated about what I see here. I haven't made any public statements or even got involved until I heard what you guys' final statement was. And I feel like we've been left out. We've been deceived by thinking that there was something that was going to happen with this police review board. We still have the same policies that are going to be in effect now, and no way to retaliate. And you have basically politically exonerated the city council, which I think is definitely in fault here. That just may just be more of a statement than a question. But.
Do you have any criticisms about how the report was put together? We
have some suggestions on the report from the DA's office that we're going to forward to them as to numbering pages and putting it in order.
Okay, and do you have any criticisms as to how the investigation was?
And you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, your Sunday afternoon Civil Rights for the Poor show. We're examining the case of John Dine, shot dead, two shots to the gut by Officer Connor Carey in November of last year. And you've been listening to a press conference by Dr. Bill Christie, head of the Citizens Police Review Board. The conference happened last Tuesday. I think that was probably... 11th or 12th, something like that. The conference took place in front of the alternate media and in front of the Santa Cruz Sentinel and the San Jose Mercury News, and I believe Channel 8 was also on the scene. I let this conference simply play for you so you could just hear how it went. I was really eager to interrupt at certain points since Bill Christie, amicable and amiable a guy as he is, was... Well, I'd like to say he was full of shit in some respects. I mean, it doesn't seem appropriate to say that because I like him as a person. But the kinds of comments he made upset me. But rather than convey my upsetness, I'd rather bring into the conversation a woman who has thoroughly read over the district attorney's report, interviewed numerous witnesses herself for videotape, actually produced a program for... Club Cruz on the John Dine case and written a lengthy article on the issue, which you can find in the January issue of Street Spirit, a homeless newspaper. I'm referring, of course, to a video journalist and Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure member, Becky Johnson, who I have on the line.
Hi, Becky.
Hi, Robert.
And you heard that interview again on the air?
Yes, I was at the press conference, and you probably, your listeners heard me. I was one that asked the question about how they discounted three eyewitnesses who called it murder, and then you heard council member Michael Hernandez attempting to shut down the press conference at that point, unsuccessfully, I'm glad to say. I'm, you know, a member spokesperson of Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure, and our organization was completely upset by the decision of the Citizens Police Review Board. We feel that have acted to support the cover-up of the true facts of what happened.
Was this an unexpected decision, Becky, in your mind, or what did you expect from it?
Not for those who of us who have been observing the CPRB in its basically in its entire 2 years of operation. That many, many times they have held the statements of police officers to be more credible than the statements of complaining witnesses.
Which is kind of ironic because this is supposed to be the counterforce to the internal investigation process which the police department itself undertakes. You know, I noticed that, you know, Bill Christie kept saying, and has said actually at past Citizens Police Review Board meetings, that, you know, this his body, the Citizens Police Review Board, is not really an investigative body, it is a reviewing body, and generally speaking that is true, but in this most serious case, he had the opportunity to investigate, he had the opportunity to have the board hear the different testimony from the witnesses publicly by subpoenaing the witnesses, and he and his board refused to do it, and they also had the opportunity, because I understand the city council would have supported this move, to hire an independent investigator independent of the police department, and they declined to do that as well. So, in fact, he made the choice that not only is his body not an investigative body, but he doesn't want it to be an investigative body in this most serious case.
Those were among a number of disappointments that Santa Cruzans, for full disclosure, had to the process that the Citizens Police Review Board went through. Certainly this case, had we had public hearings, then the members of the public could have more fully examined the evidence, although we don't even need an independent investigator to find fault with the Santa Cruz Police Department, the DA's conclusion in this case, after looking at the reports that are currently in the public library. We find that none of the eyewitnesses who could be separated from police witnesses, and I'm including Ben Newman as a police witness, since he was, although he's not a police officer, he was best friends with Connor Carey. It's stated in the report that he was a longtime friend. We have reports they went to junior high school together, and it would be reasonable to assume that Newman would not want to make statements that would get his best friend in trouble, and that should have caused both the DA and the police department and the CPRB to put less weight on the testimony of Ben Newman.
Or at least perhaps to call Ben Newman and the police officers to retestify before an independent interrogator. I mean, I noticed that they didn't ask any questions about whether these folks knew previously what about John Dine, about his practice of playing with toy guns.
Well, the CPRB heard directly from Alan Van Cleve, who was a former counselor of John Dine's, and he stated at their review board that that John Dine had had some trouble with a bouncer at the Catalyst, and that a bouncer at the Catalyst had forbidden him from the entire sidewalk in front of the Catalyst, not just in front of the Catalyst, but the entire block from Maple Street to Cathcart.
And certainly people from the Catalyst could have been subpoenaed to a public hearing to testify as to whether this was the case.
It seemed to be no concern to the CPRB whether Newman had had previous encounters with John Dine or whether he didn't know him at all.
You know, there are a couple of new bits of information that have come to light since. I guess you were talking to Attorney Ed Fry last night.
That's correct.
And apparently one bit of testimony that you can't get by looking at the DA's report in the library is the transcript of police transmissions back and forth between the officers and, I guess, the dispatcher in the minutes before and the minutes after the shooting. Do you have any information for us on that?
Ed has obtained a copy of the transmission, and he's listened to it, and he described it as having an 18-minute gap. Most of the tape is blank. Perhaps what they've done is edited out anything that didn't have to do with the case. That's possible. But it leads us to be concerned that the tape may have been altered, or things that regarding the case that were germane may, but perhaps embarrassing to the police department, have also been edited out. So we found that particular piece of evidence has been contaminated, or is called into question.
Yeah, what interests me also is Christie noted that this report by the Citizens Police Review Board, that we with the press conference, the exonerating of the officers and the police chief, was unanimous. That is to say, all six members, now there's seven, but I guess the seventh didn't vote because she was new, voted, you know, that the complaints against the police officer who did the shots, Officer Carey, he was exonerated, and the complaints against Belcher were unfounded.
Which is
a lower level. You know, it's just that there's nothing to those complaints. It's hard for me to imagine such unanimity. When we talked to a police review board member, Bruce Morse, who was supposedly going to talk to us in greater detail, but then just skipped out and kept us waiting for an hour at a meeting over cold coffee, he said that they had more information. Again, we can't tell, you know. What do you think about it?
Well, Bill Christie alluded to some of the information that was not in the DA's report, most notably John Dine's rap sheet, what he had been charged with previously, both in Santa Cruz and elsewhere. There was a reference made to that by District Attorney Art Danner, where he claimed that John Dine had been charged with assault with a deadly weapon in Santa Clara. I noted that he'd been charged. Had he been convicted, I'm sure that District Attorney Art Danner would have mentioned that. So I concluded that the charges had been dropped. We did not see any police reports regarding John Dine's previous history. And I'm reluctant to just take Bill Christie's, had he seen those reports, take his assessment at face value, considering what he did with the reports that we have seen.
It's interesting that he was making comments about the facts of the case where he obviously believed the accounts of the police officers. And one wonders that if he was so sure that, and there was a unanimous decision, that at least 51% of the evidence said that these officers, the police chief and Officer Carey and Officer Over, I guess, who was a subject of a couple of the complaints, were not guilty of any kind of misconduct here. If he really believed that, as an individual who knows the kind of public significance this case has, what would be his problem in airing the issue publicly? I guess I keep getting back to the idea that he must be afraid of embarrassing the police department.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, or do we actually believe that he and the rest of the group really were seriously and
well, we're in the dark. We're in the dark here about what the process the CPRB did and how they discounted these witnesses. Who not only did not see a gun in John Dine's hand, but at least three of them, no, four witnesses claimed that his hands were empty. Witness Alani Ballowager on the roof of the New Leaf said in her statement to the police that if John Dine had had a gun in his hand, she would have seen it. The darkness factor was raised several times. People
she also said that her companion, Isaac, her co-worker at the New Leaf, also saw nothing in Happy John's hand.
Yeah, that's correct. And we got that information from an interview conducted only a few hours after the shooting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it certainly was true. And I think that
she could see the guns in the hands of the police officers. Common sense would say that if at that distance she could see the guns in the hands of the police officers, then she could also see a gun in John Dine's hand if he had had one.
And indeed, I brought this up at the press conference. You heard me asking the questions. Every non-police witness, other than the two officers and Ben Newman, saw no weapon. As a consequence, it sounds like to me, the CPRB decided to go with the Carey story, which has always been somewhat different
mm-hmm.
than the Over Newman story. The Carey story, of course, is these reaching for a weapon. If we are to go with the Carey story and
mm-hmm.
say here was John Dine reaching for a weapon, how does this mesh with what the other witnesses saw in your view?
It's close, but the major difference is his statement that he repeatedly told John Dine to not move before shots were fired, when all of the eyewitnesses that were close enough to hear that heard the shots, and then they heard him say, don't move. And that's John Blake, the manager of McWhirter's, heard the shots and then heard, don't move afterwards. Lee Chiron, the skateboarder, also heard the shots and heard, don't move. That was witness Clinton Hannes and witness Mike Schultz. So there are, four witnesses from different angles who all concur on that point. And indeed, Ben Newman and even Martin Over do not concur with Connor Carey on that. Ben Newman is claiming he said freeze five times, and Martin Over doesn't really know what Connor Carey said. But
what Newman said that Carey said the word freeze five times?
Newman said he said the word freeze five times, and not a single other witness ever heard the word freeze used.
So mm-hmm. it seems...
And Martin Over, the other officer, claims that he had said, "Hi, Happy, how are you? We just want to talk to you." No witness heard that either.
So, what is the significance of this? I mean,
the significance, of course, is that the official report has always been that Connor Carey had given sufficient warning to John Dine, instructed him to not move or to show his hands or something prior to being shot. Obviously, if he was shot and then given instructions to not move, it's a little late at that point to say that he was properly warned.
What is the significance of...
It also doesn't seem likely, given, say, Sergeant Andy Crane, who claims that the incident happened so quickly that from the time the officers exited the vehicle and shots were fired, only 5 seconds elapsed.
Now, Dr. Christie says that Liana Forrest confirms the motion of John Dine in reaching for some weapon, as the new official story has it. Do any other witnesses either contradict or support that claim?
Motion. The motion that was reported, I think, by three witnesses, Stacy Buckaloo, Leslie Plumley, and Liana Forrest, all reported that they thought they saw his hand come out in front, approximately just below waist level.
So that is consistent with Carey's story.
Well, Carey is actually claiming he was reaching the other direction.
He
was reaching for his right front pocket at the time he was shot.
And what are the witnesses?
So those three witnesses are actually inconsistent with Carey's statement.
So what do the three witnesses say that differs from Carey's perspective?
They say that his hand was forward at the time that the shots were fired.
Mm-hmm.
But hand forward with nothing in it.
They say he had nothing in it.
Yes.
Well, Becky, let me ask you to, what I'd like to do now is I'd like to read a few other items. And
I just had one more comment to make about the tape we just heard, and that was two extremely important misstatements made by Bill Christie.
Go ahead.
He discounted Stacy Buckaloo and Mike Schultz's testimony because he claimed they were the fourth vehicle back.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually the position of witness David Plumley. Stacy and Mike Schultz were the second vehicle back, and once the pickup truck in front of them had moved out of the way, they were the first vehicle and had it. And the other statement was, he said Stacy said that she could not see because the truck was in a way. That is out and out false. She said the truck was not obscuring her vision in any way.
Do we know who was in the truck?
Yes, that was Leslie Plumley.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Becky Johnson. I guess are you continuing to work on this case for Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure? Is the committee in hiatus? What's happening with it?
We're considering our next move. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with the CPRB, a lot of anger. We feel that they have done a gross disservice to the citizens of Santa Cruz and have failed in their duty to hold the police in check. We feel that they have handed a carte blanche to the police department in Santa Cruz, that they can shoot any citizen at will, and as long as they remember to make it a point-blank shooting so that they're the closest witness to the incident.
Thank you, Becky.
And you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrop Spears' Broadside Civil Rights Show on Sunday. Every Sunday, starts at 11, goes to 1:30. We're examining the Citizens Police Review Board's report on the Happy John Dine killing. A couple of things have been written about this, which I'm going to read you. One of them was a speech that I gave to the City Council on Tuesday night. Pretty good speech called Breaking Faith with the Community, an Ominous Crossroads, and I'll pass it on to you here. Today, that was last Tuesday, is a historic day of sorts. For some of us, it's the day that Worcester, Massachusetts Food Not Bombs goes to court to defend its right to share free food. For others, it's the day Dan Lundgren vowed he would shut down many state cannabis clubs. But in Santa Cruz, it's the day we finally saw the Citizens Police Review Board stripped bare of the hopes and illusions many of us had invested in it. I admit to being a critic of the board from the beginning, believing it was intractably delayed in its birth, formed with too weak a structure and given too few powers. I watched helplessly while the best members resigned in disgust, and those who remained floated passively along or remained embroiled in arcane legalisms far removed from the real issues of justice the board was created to address. I blanched when the board bent over for Sergeant Clark's vindictive investigation of John Malkin, a board member who later resigned, for the harassment of board member Gia Grant for nuisance tickets, who also resigned, for the standard of evidence used to obstruct complaints against Belcher's police department, harsher than elsewhere, and for the illegal diversion of complaints into the free-from-oversight inquiry category by the police department, which was upheld by the Citizens Police Review Board, or not seriously challenged in a public fashion. Year after year, I saw the board refusing to use what powers it had to subpoena testimony, command witnesses to appear, seek public hearings, and even request an occasional independent investigation. Never. Not once did they do this. Not once have they done this. But when the Happy John Dine killing came up, the case where Police Chief Belcher decided in concert with D.A. Art Danner 16 hours after Carey shot Dine dead, here, I thought, was something this board could not ignore. I was wrong. Just as council members we thought were progressive showed their own colors here in this forum in their backroom move to unseat Celia Scott as mayor, and their successful move to deny Byers membership on the budget committee, so Citizens Police Review Board members have shown their true colors in the Dine case. As at City Council, the Citizens Police Review Board has shown its distaste for real extended community involvement in public process. We will not have public hearings. We will not hear the discussions or the thinking of the CPRB members. It will all happen behind closed doors. The CPRB invested itself in the result, not in the crucial process of determining what was true through an open process. This was obvious from the stumbling press conference held today on Tuesday, which you actually just heard rebroadcast today on Sunday, where the board chair, Bill Christie, kept confusing witnesses. Police cannot credibly investigate themselves. Even the sheriff's department cannot credibly investigate the Santa Cruz Police Department. That's a basic principle. In this particular case, when every single non-police witness saw no toy gun in Happy John Dine's hand, nothing pointed at the police officer, and no threat, it becomes mere posturing to affirm the police case without a real investigation and real hearings. In refusing to hold public hearings...